But then I started getting hit in the back of the head. And my thought at the time was that I was being hit by a beer bottle. But I mean, it was, I was being hit hard. I'm still holding on to him because I don't want to let him go. Because as far as I'm concerned, this guy's going to jail. Well, I was being kicked and hit and punched. And again, I'm just not going to let go of this guy though, because as far as I'm concerned, me and him are leaving together and he's going to be wearing a pair of bracelets. And again, I keep thinking help's on the way, right? You know, help's not on the way. And I'm getting badly hurt because the blows keep coming to the back of my head. And so I realized that, you know, I'm going to have to kill this son of a bitch behind me, because otherwise he's going to kill me. So I push away from this guy that I've been, you know, holding on to. And as I turn, I draw my gun and I'm turning toward whoever is behind me hitting me. And I couldn't see anything. Everything was just this big blur. And I mean, it seemed like there was a thousand colors, you know, all the people and the lights and everything. And I had blood in my eyes, but I was also almost unconscious at that time. And my last thought was, don't shoot, because I didn't know where my target was. I didn't want to shoot innocent people.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is retired Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department homicide detective Danny R. Smith, who is with us for a second time to talk about his excellent law enforcement memoir, Nothing Left to Prove. During his career, Danny went from patrolling the streets of South Los Angeles to the LA Sheriff's Department's elite homicide bureau. During the crack cocaine epidemic of the late 80s and 90s, unprecedented gang warfare, a spike in homicides that stunned the nation, and the Rodney King riots. Today, he's going to tell us about some of the more unusual and dramatic cases he investigated, including that of a Native American who was burned alive by skinheads. And he's going to talk about how two decades of horrific violence and a steady stream of death left him mentally scarred and forced him to leave the profession he loved. It's my great honor to welcome retired Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department homicide detective Danny R. Smith as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Danny, thanks so much for doing this. I love your book, Nothing Left to Prove. It's a great police detective memoir. I recommend it to everybody.
Thank you, Ralph.
So let's just jump in with your background. How did you get into police work in the first place?
Well, you know, I sort of like many guys that are just graduating from high school, I floundered a bit. I never liked school, so going to college really didn't interest me that much. I was kind of set on joining the military, and my dad talked me out of that. And at the time, the military was kind of going through, it was 1980. And, you know, we were at the end of the Carter administration, and the military had been cut dramatically. And there really weren't, it was different in those days. Like, not a lot of guys were leaving high school and joining the military. And my father had served. He was a war veteran, as were two of his brothers, one who was killed in action. And my dad really wanted me to just go to college and you know, make a career for myself. So I did that. I went to junior college. And while I was doing that, I began work at a place called Bendix. And it was a corporation that had military contracts. And they had a pretty serious security set up there. And one of my friends actually was working there, and he says, "Hey, Danny, you know, this is a great place to work while you're going to college, because you can do homework literally while you're working and being paid. You know, you have these duties, but the duties are not so demanding that you can't do your homework." And at the time, I think it was like $4.50 an hour, and that was pretty good money. So I took that job, and I, you know, hadn't. I mean, you know, as a kid, I kind of, you know, played cops and like, you know, a lot of boys, you know, thought it'd be cool to be a cop, but I hadn't really given that much thought throughout my teenage years. And then I'm working at this security operation, and my two bosses were retired LAPD cops. Mm. And they just really had an impact on me. And I loved everything about these two men. They were just great men. Their names were George Bettsworth and Ron Borgstrom. And they were just, I mean, these guys were just like, you know, men's men, cops, and everything about them, the way they carried themselves, the war stories that they told, the way they talked with people and joked with people. I'm like, man, these guys are cool. And that's pretty much what set me on the path to law enforcement. And then there were a series of things that occurred after that. I decided, you know, well, I can't be a cop till I'm 21. And back then in LA, that was the case. And I wanted to do more than what I was doing then. So I actually began working at a security company where you have to get licensed by the state to be an armed patrol officer and licensed to carry a weapon and all of that. And you go through some training. And so I did that. And, you know, basically I was a real live wannabe cop at that point and working, you know, all through, you know, West LA and Wilshire and Beverly Hills and, mm-hmm. And a lot of places where, you know, there was a huge clientele that hired us to protect the property and them. So I did that for a couple of years.
During that time, you had an encounter with Muhammad Ali.
I did. I actually, it was kind of cool. I mean, you'd meet a lot of different, movie stars or famous people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some were very pleasant, others were not.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of great stories about some of the encounters there, but Muhammad Ali was a really interesting one because he lived in a gated community that was within the area we patrolled, and the entire gated community contracted us. And because it was a private gated community, I mean, we basically were law enforcement in that community. Hmm. You know, of course, the cops could and would come in there, but for the most part, they relied on us to protect that community. We had a sentry stationed at the entrance, and anyone that came or went had to sign in or out, and you had to either be a guest that was on the guest list, or the sentry would have to call and ask, you know, whoever they were going to go see, hey, you know, is this guy allowed to come in? And so so one day, and quite honestly, there were Muhammad Ali he was a cool guy. You know, he had come and go. He was always real friendly with the guys at the gate and everything. And he was kind of a funny guy, but he was one of the friendly ones. Some people, they treated us like we were their gardeners, and you know, that's okay. But Ali was not that guy.
Yeah.
But I'd never had a personal conversation or interaction with him other than just waving to him. And then one day there was this former child actor who became famous later in life for just kind of being a real turd. And I won't mention his name, but he went through the gate one day and the sentry there had tried to stop him. And he basically told him to FO and continued on. And the sentry, you know, he was an Englishman that was a funny little guy, but he called us, the patrol guys, and said, hey, you know, this asshole's, you know, busted through the gate and he won't listen to me and he flipped me the bird. And, you know, so that's an automatic trespassing. I mean, it's private property, the entire area is. So we go there and Mike was the sentry. And I said, so where'd this guy go, Mike? And he's like, well, where do you think? He went to Ali's house. And because that was kind of where some of these guys would go that, you know, were, you know, not real polite at the gate. So I go there. And I walk up and I had a partner with me and we go and knock on the door and Ali answers the door himself, which was kind of a shock to me. I think I expected, you know, a servant or someone else. I mean, this is a mansion.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big mansion.
Yeah.
Actually, I have to back up. When we first got out of the car, there was a guy that lived across the street and he was a famous musician and he was black and he asked me, he says, hey, are you looking for such and such? And we said, yeah. He goes, well, that asshole went into Ali's house. And when we started to go up there, he said, he goes, hey, arrest that and use the N-word.
Yeah.
And he was none too happy about this guy, you know, and I guess he would come into the community every once in a while, and he wasn't welcome there. So I go and knock on the door, and Ali answered the door, and it was just kind of this really crazy encounter, because here's this guy. I mean, I'm within a jab reach of him. You don't want to get jabbed by this guy, right?
No, no.
But he's just big, and he's just, I mean, just this, you know, massive guy that, you know, and he was very low key and very cool. And he, you know, greeted me and shook my hand and everything. And I said, hey, you know, where's such and such? And he says, oh, he's not here. I don't have any idea. And I said, you know, Mr. Ali, I said, he blew past the sentry, you know, they tried to stop him. He told our sentry to FO, your neighbor's upset about him being here. He saw him come into your house. And while I'm having this conversation, the guy walks through the house right behind him. I'm like, he's right there. He's right behind you. And Ali kind of turns and looks, and he seemed a little bit embarrassed. And he says, I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
And I said, well, thank you, sir. I said, you know, because this whole community hires us to enforce these rules, and we need your cooperation.
Yeah.
So he shakes my hand, tells me thank you and all of that. And my partner and I would go back out to our car, and my partner looks at me, he goes, I can't believe you just chewed Ali's ass. And I'm like, I didn't chew anyone's ass.
Yeah. Yeah. I just asked him a couple questions. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it was just kind of something that later, as I went through life, and especially as I became a cop and everything, I realized that at the time I was 19 years old. So, I mean, I'm a young guy.
Yeah.
But I realized that I had that personality of being able to take command of a situation,
mm-hmm.
In spite of the fact that, you know, I've got this famous and extremely wealthy individual who could, you know, pound me into the pavement, you know, with a couple of shots. Yet I had that authoritative approach,
mm-hmm.
and I handled it like a gentleman, but still I was, it didn't matter to me who he was at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I found that as I went through life in my law enforcement career, that was a trait that's pretty important to have as a cop.
Yeah, I've heard that over and over. It's sort of taking over a situation.
Yeah, and I think that some people it just comes naturally. I don't know.
Yeah,
but and others might have to learn it. But for me, it just kind of came naturally. And I don't know. Maybe I'm just bossy.
Yeah. Well, if you can deal with Muhammad Ali, you could probably deal with anybody, right? If you're not intimidated by him.
Yeah, I mean, he was a cool guy. I'll reiterate that, man. He really was a cool guy, and this was back before it was known that he had the Parkinson's, and you know, he was kind of a slow moving guy and slow speaking guy, but he certainly, there was no signs of him having the disease that ultimately was pretty pretty hard on his life.
Yeah. And another time you came across a man covered in blood knocking on doors in Benedict Canyon.
Yeah. Yeah. Still working for the security company, Westech.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're working in that area, you know, and I worked there for 2 years, basically all of those areas, you learn the history of those areas, and you learn where the different movie stars live and the famous people and the rich people. And a lot of them are your clients. So you interact with them. You know, I met, Priscilla Presley at 3:30 in the morning when her alarm went off, and that was super cool. She was a class act. She really was a very, very nice lady and very and gorgeous at 3:30 in the morning, believe it or not.
Yeah.
But but you learn these things, and one of the things that I learned early on in life was the history of the Manson murders.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you know, a guy that already has worked there and knows the layout, he'll drive you up there and say, this is where that happened. And
yeah,
you know, so it was kind of a eerie place, you know, and even though it'd been a number of years since that had occurred, Benedict Canyon just kind of had that feel about it at night, you know, when it was dark.
In addition to being the scene of the gruesome and infamous Manson family murders of 1969, The Benedict Canyon neighborhood of Los Angeles, which runs from Sunset Boulevard and Beverly Hills to the south, north through the Santa Monica Mountains to Mulholland Drive, has been the scene of other headline-making events over the years, including the murder of gangster Bugsy Siegel in the home of his girlfriend in June 1947. That same year, Howard Hughes crashed his experimental plane near there, destroying three houses, a scene that was recreated by Martin Scorsese in his movie The Aviator. In 1958, actress Lana Turner stabbed and killed her gangster boyfriend there. His name was Johnny Stepanto. Other former and current residents of the neighborhood include Fred Astaire, Bruce Springsteen, Jimi Hendrix, Eddie Murphy, Rudolph Valentino, Cary Grant, and Sharon Stone.
Well, there was also at the very top of Benedict Canyon, there was a place up there back in those days that like a plateau that overlooked the city, and kids used to go up there for, you know, necking or, you know, drinking or smoking dope or whatever. and sometimes that, you know, that was, you know, another source of either problems or entertainment, depending on how you looked at it. But the one night that you've mentioned, I get a call actually several calls were coming into the dispatch saying, you know, there's some guy who's bloody and he's screaming and he's pounding on doors. So, you know, there are numerous different clients that had triggered their alarms or called in and said, hey, you know, you got to get someone up here.
Yeah.
And they always called us because, you know, and I'm not bad mouthing the boys in blue, you know, my friends from LAPD, but LAPD was notoriously slow in response. So they would call us. They knew we would be there within minutes.
Yeah.
I'm driving up the canyon. You know, I've still got, you know, this whole Manson murder canyon thing going on in my mind. And it was kind of a little bit, you know, eerie thinking, you know, where's this bloody guy and when's he going to pop right out? And sure enough, I come around a corner, he pops right out. He's in front of my car in the headlights. I hit a spotlight, put the spotlight on him. And this guy's just torn up and bloody and I'm thinking, you know, wow, what has happened here? So I get out and of course,
yeah,
you know, as I'm contacting him and he's kind of hysterical. I'm trying to keep him at a distance, but I'm also looking around because why is he bloody and torn up? And is there a threat that I need to be aware of? And
yeah,
anyway, long story short, I get him calmed down and he tells me this story that was kind of amusing. And I had to put it in the book. My daughter insisted that I put it in the book because, you know, I told my family about it, you know, many years later, but, the story was he was hitchhiking down on Sunset and this guy picks him up and he's like, you want to go party, you know? So they drive up Benedict Canyon up to the plateau and they're up there partying and smoking dope and drinking. And then on the way back down the canyon, this is what the bloody guy tells me. He says, you know, the guy that picked me up, he says, we're driving down the canyon at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour. And he says, hey, open the door. I got to throw some trash out. And he says, so I open my door and he kicks me out of the car, you know?
Oh my
so,
God. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
whoa,
I hate to say it, but it's kind of funny just because, you know, that whole open the door, I got to throw some trash out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
yeah. You don't realize you're the trash.
Yeah. And it kind of, it became one of those things, like, I mean, the family would joke, you know, we'd drive down the street and, you know, that your wife's giving you a shit or whatever. You're just kind of joking around. You say, hey, open the door. I got to throw some trash out. And everyone knows, everyone gets the reference to that. But it was a bizarre night.
That is bizarre.
Yeah.
So then you decide to join the sheriff's department. What was the thinking behind that decision?
So my two LAPD mentors mm-hmm. told me, go with the sheriff's department. LAPD is past her prime.
Okay.
And at the time, I mean, you know, LAPD was going under, you know, just a ton of scrutiny and,
yeah,
you know, the mayor didn't get along with the police chief, you know, and Daryl Gates. And it just seemed like LAPD had a real heavy thumb on them. And by then, and especially working in that security company, Westech, where you're interacting with cops all the time, because, you know, if something happens, you have to arrest someone. Well, you make that arrest, but you're really just a citizen, and it's a citizen's arrest, and then you have to call the police, and they come and take them away and everything. Mm-hmm. You get to know a lot of cops.
Yeah.
And some were LAPD, some were sheriffs, but you just get to know a lot of people. And there were, I mean, it was a kind of a general consensus. Pretty much everyone was like, you know, the sheriff's department's a better department. You know, they don't have all the political difficulty that LAPD is experiencing. You know, and back in that day, that was true.
Yeah.
You know, over the last decade or more, the sheriff's department has really kind of gone downhill as well. But back when I hired on, I mean, the sheriff's department was the place to work. Uh-huh. And of course, I had a ton of opportunity, you know, with having the entire county of Los Angeles.
Yeah. A huge amount of territory that the sheriff's department patrols.
Yeah. And hundreds of assignments, you know, a lot of different things you can do. And you know, I've got guys I worked with that, you know, some promoted, many of them went to SWAT, many of them went to homicide like I did. But I mean, I got guys that, you know, started flying helicopters, you know, they started out as an observer and learned to fly, and then they're flying the big Sikorskis. And I mean, just,
wow,
there's just all kinds of stuff. Other guys that, you know, work at the marina and they scuba dive for a living and stuff like that. So, I mean, there's a lot of opportunity and the sheriff's department is what I had set my mind to when it was time for me to start applying. That was my priority.
And then early in your career, I think you were actually working the marina area, and you had this incident on New Year's Day. It was 1989 at a club called the Red Onion.
Yeah.
And that was sort of a rude introduction to what the dangers are for a patrolman, a policeman.
Yeah. And it wasn't really an introduction. I trained and worked at a station called Firestone, which is South Los Angeles. It no longer exists, but at the time, you know, Firestone was known to be like the toughest place to work. And it's where I wanted to work, and it's where I trained, and I was working for a couple of years. And in those couple of years, I mean, you'd be amazed at how much you learn, how many deadly encounters you get involved in, because it was such a violent area. Mm-hmm. And this is during the height of the cocaine wars and the gang warfare, and, you know, Colors was filmed down in our jurisdiction.
Yeah.
You know,
So it's just nonstop action.
Nonstop action. I mean, yeah. Yeah. It was almost overwhelming at times, you know, the amount of murders that would happen on your, you know, in your beat, and, you know, fights and shootings.
During the late 80s, Danny was assigned to Firestone Station in South LA when the crack cocaine epidemic was in full swing, as were the turf wars between various gangs, including the Bloods and Crips, over control of the drug trade in inner city neighborhoods of LA County. That meant constant drive-by shootings, overdoses, drug busts, break-ins, vehicle thefts, and robberies. Danny says it was a very rare night when, as a cop patrolling the streets, you didn't go out and make at least one arrest. Multiple arrests a night was more the norm. Murder rates in the years between 1980 and 1990 averaged an unprecedented 1,000 per year.
It was something. So, actually I had volunteered to go to the marina for, to be on loan for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. Because the marina not having much action, sometimes they wanted to send their trainees over to Firestone for a couple months to let them, you know, get some experience. And at the time, my partner and I, we just, you know, we kind of were shit magnets, and we had just been involved in a lot, and we had a couple of lawsuits going against us. We had a couple of internal investigations going against us. And, you know, I mean, it was a result of doing our job. I mean, we weren't dirty cops or anything, but it's just when you're taking lots of bad guys to jail and, you know, some of them, you know, want to fight and others want to shoot, I mean, you end up being involved in investigations. And it wasn't uncommon, but the point is, I looked at this opportunity and I told my partner at the time, Pat, I said, you know, I said, it seems to me like, they're going to rain on our parade pretty quick, because, you know, we're shit magnets. We just keep getting into, you know, these ordeals that, you know, hair raising the result had been, you know, like I said, a few investigations, a couple of civil suits. And I thought, I'm going to go cool my heels and work in the marina for a few months. And my roommate at the time, he was actually working there. He had gone from Firestone over to the marina. And I thought, you know, that'd be cool. I can work with Bobby and we'll carpool back and forth and whatever.
Look at the boats and...
And the gals, you know, I mean, I was single. I was single till... In fact, I was single until I promoted to detectives. I was almost 30 by the time I got married. So my entire patrol career, I was single, which, you know, is pretty cool because, you know, being single and being a cop it can be a lot of fun. So I go to the marina and the one place where you could count on there being trouble was the Red Onion. And the station even had this policy that no one goes into the Red Onion without backup.
Yeah.
Because they have one man cars over there. In Firestone, we were all two man cars. Mm-hmm. So on New Year's night, the
And Red Onion is a club, a bar.
So yeah, it was a restaurant. And then below the restaurant, you go down this staircase and the entire bottom level was basically, you know, a nightclub.
Okay.
And it was a very popular nightclub. Mm-hmm. And it would just get packed and it was, you know, crazy. But when I first went over to the marina, my first day there, you know, they put me on day shift and they send me out and said, here's your RD map, your reporting district. And, you know, here's your call sign, go do your stuff. So I go out there. Well, I'd been a cop for a few years by then. And I was a pretty good cop, you know, by most of my peers' estimation. And I took lots of people to jail. You know, I mean, I just was good at you know, finding felons and being able to pull them in. So I'm out there about an hour and I see a guy that just was a really good stop. And I had a legitimate reason to stop him. But anyways, long story short, you know, I get this guy with a gun, you know, my first 2 hours on patrol in marina. So I arrest him and I'm at the station booking him and people are coming by, you know, they're fascinated, like, man, you got a guy with a gun, you know, now in Firestone. I used to be a gun magnet. Like I catch gangsters with guns all the time. I mean, at times it was almost uncanny how many guns and bad guys I'd haul to jail.
You just had a sense of kind of person, the behavior of a person who was carrying a gun.
I can't explain it, Ralph. It's like, you know, good cops. And I mean, you know, there's thousands or more out there. You have an instinct and you look at a guy and I like to say it's kind of like, because people can relate to this, I say it's like being a mom. You know, your kid comes into the house and you glance at him and that mom knows right now, what the hell have you done? You know, just the look on his face, like, you know.
What happened at school today?
Yeah, yeah. I think I wrote in my book that same analogy, you know, did you set the cat on fire outside or something, you know, because there's just something.
Yeah.
Well, that's how good cops are. And it's not racial profiling because it didn't matter the color of a person. Mm-hmm. It's just the interaction, you know, the you know, how they look at you or how they don't look at you.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there's certain things about a person that, you know, tell you right away that the guy's a gangster or a parolee, you know, a parolee when you see him. I mean, every cop, they look at a guy and go, that guy's right out of the joint.
Yeah.
You know, and it's from the way they hold themselves, the way they carry themselves, the way they stand, the way they walk. Everything.
Yeah.
So I get this gun arrest and, you know, I'm cleaning that whole thing up and the captain calls me into his office. I'm thinking, oh, you know, it's my first day here. He's probably going to welcome me aboard. I go in there and the guy starts chewing my ass, telling me that this isn't Firestone and you're not going to be out here, you know, pulling people over and taking them to jail. And I'm sitting there thinking, and he tells me, he says, you know, you've got investigations and you're in a fishbowl and I'm watching you.
Wow.
And that was a quote.
Yeah.
And I kind of got pissed off.
Yeah.
And when I walked in, I had walked in and went to shake his hand and he said, sit down.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
I mean, I'd never met this guy before.
Yeah.
And, so I left his office and I was pissed off and I said, okay, well, I'm on vacation then. I'm literally on vacation. Actually, the first thing I did is I called Firestone. I said, hey, I want to come back, you know, undo this trade.
This isn't fun.
And the training scheduling sergeant laughed at me. He said, Danny, he goes, you can't do that. You're stuck, man. You made the deal. You're there.
Yeah.
So then I decided, okay, well, I'm on vacation then. That's it. Yeah. I'm gonna freaking drive around with blinders on and just put in my time, you know, write a few tickets here and there, but whatever.
Yeah.
And so fast forward a couple months, and that's what I did. I mean, I literally had a commitment to not do shit. Mm-hmm. And in the marina, that's pretty easy and no one cares.
Yeah, it's a pretty chill place. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So on the New Year's deal, one of the guys that works there, I pass him on the main street there. I don't even remember the name of it now, but it's right where the Red Onion is. And he sees me and gets me on the car to car frequency and says, "Hey, you want to back me up? I'm going to go do a bar check." Mm-hmm. And I roll my eyes thinking, "Oh God, no, I don't want to go into the Red Onion. I mean, this is New Year's. This place is freaking packed."
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I know no good could come from this. Yeah, you know what I mean.
And a bar check is just checking ID type of thing, or
just making your presence known, walking through there, making sure everything's cool or whatever. But I knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to go in there and check out the girls because I mean,
New Year's Eve.
There's going to be 1,000 freaking scantily clad women in there dancing and having fun and partying.
Yeah.
But there's also going to be an equal number of testosterone driven and alcohol fueled idiots, that are part of that equation. So I go in there, I reluctantly, because I'm not going to tell a guy, no, I'm not going with you.
Yeah.
I'm like, God damn it. So okay, fine, let's go. So we park right in front, on the red curb, because that's why God made red curbs, just so policemen have somewhere to park. And we don't care what the firemen say. But anyway, so we spiral down this staircase down into this place. And I mean, you could feel the beat pump in and you're it's just loud and crowded and hot in there, hot, sweaty.
Yeah.
And a lot of scenery, and I'm walking through, and of course, again, I'm a young guy and I'm single and I'm looking at some of these ladies and this gal turns around and bumps right into me, and we're nose to nose, and she looks at me and smiles and apologizes, and I apologize, and that was like my last decent encounter at the marina, because from that point on everything went to shit. What happened while I was looking in her eyes, I hear and kind of see this commotion off to the side, my peripheral vision, and I look over, and the guy that I had recognized as one of the bouncers in the bar is getting his ass kicked.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, there's someone just punching his lights out. Now, I'm not the brightest guy on earth, Ralph, I have to tell you, because I should have said, "Hey, if the bouncer's getting his ass kicked,
that's not a good sign.
How much of this do I really want?"
Yeah.
But I'm not real bright. So I immediately go at him. And as I'm approaching, I've got this in my mind: you're in a fishbowl and I'm watching you.
Yeah.
And that had been on my mind for this. I'd only been there like 4 or 5 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm the whole time, all I kept thinking is every time I did something, I'm thinking, if I have to put my hands on someone, if anything happens at all, and there's a complaint, he's going to crucify me, this freaking captain.
Yeah.
So, as I approach, I didn't approach the way I would have in other circumstances. Because when there's a significant violent encounter, you have to rise to that level and meet it head on.
The same energy.
Yeah. And again, I mean, this guy that was doing the ass kicking obviously was a very, very tough guy. It turned out he was a trained kickboxer and a very, very tough guy. But as I'm approaching, I shine my freaking light at him, and I'm flashing the light, and I'm trying to yell over all the noise and stuff, but I'm trying to get his attention so he knows the cops are here.
Yeah.
Because, it seemed like, especially back then, that most civilized people, even if they're in a fight, once the cops are there, it's like, okay,
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Over.
He looked at me. I know he recognized that as a cop. And he turned around and hit this guy again. I mean, this bouncer's like, just barely even still awake.
Wow.
And that's when I made my second mistake, is that rather than just freaking, coming down on him, whatever. I mean, I should have used the flashlight and just hit him in the head or something. But I put the flashlight in my back pocket. You have what they call sap pockets. They're long, skinny, narrow pockets on the backs of your legs, separate from your regular hip pocket. And your flashlight fits in there nicely. So I put my flashlight back there so that I could have both hands, and I grabbed him because I wanted to stop him from fighting. But I didn't want to use force. I didn't want to have to, you know, El Caban him or something.
Right.
And he spun around and hit me harder than I've ever been hit in my life.
Wow. Wow.
Then or since. I've never had anyone hit me that hard. It was like, it was probably, you know, and I'd been in numerous fights. I mean, of course, by then.
Sure.
But this was one of those where you saw stars.
Yeah.
You all of a sudden understand what having your bell rung means, you know,
yeah.
Because it's like, oh, you know, my bell is ringing literally.
Right. Right.
And
I don't know where I am. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I staggered back and he came at me and he kept hitting me. And the only thought I had was, you know, I can't let this guy, you know, just tear me up because there's no way I can stand toe to toe with this guy.
Yeah.
So I grabbed him and I'm a fairly good sized guy. And back then, I was pretty strong and I had some, jiu-jitsu training and stuff. So I grab him, I lock onto him because I know that I'm safer in, you know, grasp with him than I am giving him the distance to throw those punches. And in my mind, I keep thinking at any second, you know, my partner's going to come flying in here with this can of ass whoop, you know, and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, that never happened.
Jeez.
It never happened.
Yeah.
I never saw that guy again.
Wow.
Until later on at the hospital.
Wow.
Which was puzzling to me because in Firestone, all the cops there were so aggressive that, you know, when a fight happened, there's a pretty good chance you're going to end up getting hit by another cop, you know, his baton or his flashlight or something, because everyone just is very, very aggressive, knowing that you have to handle these things quickly and not lose a fight because you can't afford to lose a fight.
Exert control right away. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty soon I realized that I'm being moved around and I feel like it's the crowd, but now I'm being hit from behind as well. And we move across the floor and I remember crashing into some kind of machine with lots of lights on it. And I never did verify later. I tell people, you know, I always said, I can't remember if it was like a cigarette machine or a jukebox or something, but we crash into this, you know, lit machine. And that's kind of where the movement stopped. But then I start getting hit in the back of the head.
Jeez.
By something very, very heavy and hard. And my thought at the time was that I was being hit by a beer bottle. You know, I thought someone was cracking me over the head with a beer bottle. But I mean, I was being hit hard. I'm still holding on to him because I don't want to let him go. As far as I'm concerned, this guy's going to jail.
This is someone else.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. Wow. Several people.
Yeah.
There were several people. I was being kicked and hit and punched. And again, I'm just not going to let go of this guy though, because as far as I'm concerned, me and him are leaving together and he's going to be wearing a pair of bracelets and, you know, and again, I keep thinking help's on the way.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and pretty soon I'm realizing that help's not on the way and I'm getting badly hurt because the blows keep coming to the back of my head.
Yeah.
And so I realized that, you know, I'm going to have to kill this son of a bitch behind me because otherwise he's going to kill me.
Yeah.
So I push away from this guy that I've been, you know, holding on to. And as I turn, I draw my gun and I'm turning toward, you know, whoever is behind me hitting me. And I couldn't see anything. Everything was just this big blur. Mm. And I mean, it seemed like there was 1,000 colors, you know, all the people and the lights and everything.
Yeah.
And I had blood in my eyes, but I was also almost unconscious at that time. And my last thought was, don't shoot.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know where my target was. I didn't want to shoot innocent people.
What's self-control?
Well, yeah, I mean, I regret. I mean, I wish I would have been able to shoot the son of a bitch that was hitting me in the head. But anyway, long story short, I later found out, well, I woke up. And a bartender was over me and telling me, stay down. You're hurt really bad. Stay down. And I tried to sit up and I remembered that I had made that thought, don't shoot. And the first thing I did was I checked my holster. My gun wasn't there. And I said, where's my gun? I mean, I was panicked.
Yeah.
Like, oh Christ, I lost my gun.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing that can happen to a cop is losing your gun in a fight, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, I put it underneath you.
Oh, wow.
And this bartender, what he had done, he was smart, is, and he was a small guy too, but a real nice guy. In fact, I had talked to him when we first walked in, I'd greeted him because I, you know,
yeah.
6 weeks there, I'd been in that bar several times. I knew the bartender, I knew the bouncers.
Mm-hmm.
So he was smart enough. What he did is he secured my weapon for me, but he also knew that, you know, and of course by then, you know, everyone been making 911 calls and everything and the cops are coming.
Yeah.
And he wasn't going to stand there over a cop that's on the ground bleeding, holding his gun.
Yeah.
Pulling the cop's gun. Yeah, right.
That's not a good.
So he lifted me up and slid it underneath.
Yeah.
Me.
Smart.
So yeah, it was very smart. So I get it and I put it in the holster. I said, help me up. You know, he's like, you need to just stay down. He said, everyone's on their way, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, I gotta get outside and see where these guys went. So he reluctantly helped me. And I had to hold on to this, I think it was like a rope that divided the in and out through that spiral staircase.
Uh-huh.
So I pulled myself up and I walk outside and there was just a lot of commotion my sergeant runs up to me and says, we got to get to the hospital. I go, we got to get some information out there,
yeah.
You know? And right about then someone came up to me and said, they left in two cars and gave me the description. So I grabbed the radio mic and I put it out and everything that, you know, this is the suspect description. And I was told then that there was four of them,
mm-hmm.
That were involved in beating me.
Mm.
And, long story short, they were gone, you know, had tons of units searching for them, trying to find them, didn't find them that night.
Mm.
They ended up being caught a couple weeks later, only because one of the guys was bragging to one of his buddies about it. And the buddy's girlfriend was sitting there listening to this and thought, this is just reprehensible, you know?
Yeah.
And she went to the station and said, did something like this happen?
Yeah.
And they yanked her across the counter. Yes. What do you know? You know, I mean, not literally, but
yeah.
And she told, and so she provided the information of all the guys that were involved in it. They were eventually arrested. And
yeah.
I'm sad to say that nothing really happened to them. They didn't do any jail time. They got probation.
Gee.
And you know, that was just an entire fiasco that was very, very sour,
yeah,
to me for,
I'm sure,
for most of my life, you know, truthfully.
I'm sure that's an awful thing to go through. What about your partner? What was his explanation?
Oh, so I'm at the hospital and they set me in the waiting room and the sergeant's filling out paperwork. And I say, Sarge, I go, tell them they need to get me into a freaking room. I'm not sitting out here in the waiting room.
Yeah.
That's not how, I mean, you know, that's not what happens to cops when you're injured and you come to a hospital. They,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And, I don't remember now if they said that there weren't any other available rooms or whatever, but the point is somehow I knew that the bouncer was already there and in a room. And I said, well, put me in with him.
Yeah.
You know? So I go in there and he says, hey, you look worse than me, man. I said, well, I took your ass beating for you, you know? What do you expect? And so we were kind of, you know, I hate to say joking, but, you know, he's like, Jesus, dude. He goes, you know, he goes, I'm a boxer. He goes, I've never been hit so hard in my life. That guy freaking,
yeah,
cleaned my clock.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, you know, I mean, he cleaned mine too.
Yeah.
And he tells me the story. Basically, he had thrown this guy and his buddies out,
mm-hmm,
a week or two before.
Oh.
Because they were in there causing trouble.
Yeah.
So he said, what happened is that night, the guy, the tough guy, he was throwing shot glasses and breaking them against the wall or something,
mm-hmm,
just to get the bouncer to come over. He wanted to have a confrontation with the bouncer.
Yeah.
And I just happened to, you know, have been so fortunate to go in there at the wrong time, you know,
but probably saved the bouncer's life.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? I never really thought of it like that, but, you know, I imagine that the bouncer probably would have been knocked out in another few seconds and the guys probably would have split. But the thing is, you know, I had equilibrium damage. I had quite a bit of damage to my head and I was off for several months. And in fact, I was supposed to be there for 6 months over at the marina on loan. And over the course of however many, you know, the next weeks and months, when the doctors were trying to decide, you know, when I'd be able to return to duty, at some point they're getting close and saying, well, how do you feel about going back? And I said, I think I'll feel really good about going back on this particular date, which was the date I was supposed to go back to Firestone. And because I said, I am not walking back into that station. I refuse to.
Yeah.
I will not go back to that station because, number one, I didn't trust myself how I was going to behave next time I saw the captain.
Yeah.
And I refused to go there. I said, no, I want to go home. I want to go back to Firestone. And that's what I did. I stayed off. It was like 6 months exactly. Uh-huh. I returned to work the day that I was supposed to be back at Firestone I was happy to be back in the ghetto.
I bet. Yeah. That was a bad situation. And what a terrible feeling that your chief doesn't have your back.
Yeah. You know? Well, and it's one thing, Ralph, to not have your back, but it's another thing to actually be out to get you for really no good reason at all.
Yeah. Like I'm watching you type of thing.
And that son of a bitch. And I put his name in my book and everything. Cause I'm like, you know, I don't even care, you know, if he wants to sue me for slander or whatever, bring it on, man. Because I hate that son of a bitch. And and I always have. I never saw him again. Never saw him again.
Oh, really?
But I told everybody, I said, you know, this is what happened and this is why. I mean, he never even called me. Or, you know, usually a cop gets hurt and their commanding officer will drive out to their house and visit with them and, hey, how are you doing? Or whatever, you know, once I was out of hospital.
Right.
Or come to the hospital or something. I never saw him.
Wow.
I think it about a month passed and he called, which I think was kind of either an obligatory call or maybe he was fishing to see how I was doing or whatever. I don't know. Uh-huh. But I was very, very brief with him on the phone. And that conversation lasted about 14 seconds. And that was it.
The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, officially the County of Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, serves Los Angeles County, California, and is the largest sheriff's department in the United States and the third largest local police agency in the country, following the New York Police Department and the Chicago Police Department. It covers an area totaling approximately 4,084 square miles with a population of almost 10 million people. As of 2022, LASD had approximately 18,000 employees, including 9,915 sworn deputies. It is not to be confused with the unrelated Los Angeles Police Department, which provides law enforcement service within the city of Los Angeles, the county seat of Los Angeles County. So let's move forward in your career. So you become a detective. How long did that process take? How many years later was that?
So I spent 5 years in patrol, which when you're working at a place like Firestone and stations, you know, similar to that, and there's places like it all over the country. When you work a fast-paced area, 5 years of patrol is like being a cop for 30 years somewhere else. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, the amount of the murders and the violence and the action, the things that you see on a daily basis, just it's 5 years is a lot.
Yeah.
And I loved working patrol and I had planned to stay in patrol, but one of those lawsuits that I mentioned, you know, one of the reasons that I went over to the Marina, I ended up being a defendant in federal court for 6 weeks behind that deal. And we had a completely winnable case. I mean, it was the attorney was this guy that specialized in suing cops, and he was a piece of shit. And everything we did was within policy. Our brass was completely 100% behind us.
Yeah.
The internal investigation came out clean. So, you know, normally it wouldn't have been a big deal to have this lawsuit, but, you know, the thing took like 3 years to get to court. It literally frickin' finally gets a jury trial set. And I don't remember now what the date was, but I remember clearly, like the day after they give us a hard and fast date, like this is going to start on this date. Mm-hmm. That night I'm sitting at home watching Rodney King get his ass kicked on TV.
Oh God.
And so, you know, that's on a continuous loop for the next, years it seemed like, but when we started trial, that thing was still all day long, every day, you know, every news channel, the freaking weather channel, you know, I mean,
yeah,
that's,
yeah, yeah. No, I remember.
That's all you saw, you know? I mean,
yeah, they repeated that so many times.
And we walked in, we walked into that trial knowing we were walking into a buzzsaw. There was no way we were going to get a fair trial with that kind of thing going on. And
yeah,
so we lost the case and we were hit with punitive damages and all kinds of things. But the case was later overturned by the Ninth Circuit of Court of Appeals. But in the meantime, you know, I'd been told that, hey, you know, this is how much money you're going to pay these two little gang banging shitbags.
Whoa.
That you had to take to jail. And so it changed me.
So that money came out of your pocket.
It was supposed to. We never had to pay because the case was overturned. And in fact, the county was going to pay our part as well. But
okay.
Because we didn't do anything wrong, you know?
Yeah.
So, but the point is, the fact that I had a jury, you know, that for 6 weeks sat there and listened to these little turds lie their asses off. I mean, they were caught lying numerous times and the judge kept dismissing it like, you know, no big deal. But that they were able to sit there and look at me and my co-defendants and then look at these gangsters and tell us, okay, you're going to pay them this.
Wow.
And I went back to work saying, what am I doing? Why am I risking life and limb every night trying to keep, you know, this place safe for women and children when this is the treatment I get in return?
Yeah.
And it took a lot out of me. That 6 weeks at federal court took a hell of a lot out of me. I changed. And I hadn't planned on going to detectives, but, you know, Firestone is a very tight-knit station, you know, almost family oriented. One of the sergeants that worked detective bureau came to me and said, Danny, we've got an opening in DB. You ought to put in for it. And I'm like, yeah, I don't know. You know, Jim, I don't really want to be a detective. I like being a street cop, you know? He says, you need to leave now because, you know, you've got a ton of respect here.
Yeah.
But everyone sees that you've changed.
Yeah.
You need to change your, you know,
different perspective.
Yes. So I did. I applied and was given the job of station detectives. And at first I hated it. I'm like, oh God, this is the most boring thing on earth. And then right after that, the riots happened, you know, because the second trial and everything. Anyways, long story short, I'm back in uniform out on the streets, which was great. You know, that was fun. I mean, because Firestone was right in the epicenter of the riots. Middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But after that, all of a sudden we were back to doing, you know, police work. And I, you know, it dawned on me, it's like being a detective, you don't have to just sit at the freaking station and do paperwork all day.
Yeah.
You know, I got the bug of writing search warrants and we were writing warrants and taking people to jail and having fun. And, you know, shortly after that, I started working what they call the night car, which is, you know, you're a detective on the PM shift. And it's different than being a day shift detective. You know, you're out there on the streets a lot and you're working a lot of interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started working the crime impact team. And I eventually was selected to go to Special Investigations Bureau, which is part of Detective Division, a countywide unit. And from there I went to homicide. So
mm-hmm.
It was once I actually embraced being a detective, I decided I got to go to homicide. That's where I want to be. I mean, that's the pinnacle of,
right,
of, you know, police work, detective work for sure, but truthfully, I mean, you know, investigating murder is that's the show.
That's the big thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you had some interesting cases. Can we talk about a couple of them?
Sure. Yeah, you bet.
I don't know which one came first, the Native American or the notorious woman who killed her first husband and ended up going after her mom, right?
Yeah. Yeah. She killed her mother. So that came first because, the Native American was later, and in fact was one of the last big cases that I handled and probably contributed quite a bit to my demise with my career.
Uh-huh.
There were other cases too that you know, the thing about working homicide in LA is you never again have your head above water. You feel like you're drowning all the time. You're constantly, you know, every 10 days you're up for murders again, and you constantly are catching a new case, and you haven't even had time to get the last three figured out.
Yeah.
And you're setting up triage, you're walking away from some cases because you don't have time to work them. So it's like the dead gangster, you know, okay, well, that might solve itself, or the gang cops might come to me someday if they lead, but I don't have time to work on it, you know? And then,
yeah.
So instead you're working on the dead kid case or.
So the pace is just relentless.
It is.
And they end up backing up.
Yeah. And you're always working, you know, they always had a cap of like 30 hours a month of overtime that they'd pay you for, but we usually work 30 hours of overtime every week, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes much more than that.
Wow.
And even when you're on your days off or on vacation, you know, the nature of being a homicide detective is you're always on the phone, you know?
Yeah.
People don't care what time of day it is or what day of the week it is or whether or not you're on vacation.
Yeah.
You know, prosecutors, attorneys, informants, victims, family members, everyone is always on the phone with you.
Yeah.
Other cops, you know, you've handled a case at a particular station and you've handed out your card and say, hey, if you come across this guy, you know, I need to talk to him. Well, if they call you at 3 a.m. and say, hey, you know, I'm at the corner of such and such, and I've got this guy you're looking for. Well, you know, one of my mentors at Homicide, a great cop named Mark Lilyfield, he told me when I was a young detective, and I worked with him at Firestone too, and he is a great cop. I mean, just a phenomenal cop. And he told me early on, he said, you know, if they call you at 3 a.m. and they've got someone that you said you wanted to talk to, he said, you get your ass out of bed, throw on a freaking suit, and you drive down there. Mm-hmm. You don't tell them, you know, well, can you get, you know, a name and address for me? I'll hit them up Monday.
Yeah. No. They'll never be around. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and like he said, if you do that, don't ever hand your card to another street cop and ask him to work for you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You owe it to him to get your ass out of bed and get down there. So
right.
That's the kind of demand that case had. And
wow.
But to get back to the Lazarevich case that you're referencing, the victim's name was Nada Lazarevich, and she was an immigrant. And just a really hardworking lady that she was a seamstress. Mm-hmm. And she had saved every penny in her life. And she had bought a modest home for, you know, with cash. And she had bought a modest car for cash. And she lived a very modest life. And she had two daughters. And we called them the good daughter and the bad daughter, because mm-hmm. it was quite clear early on that one daughter was really worried about her mother, and the other one was like, oh, she's fine. <You know? Yeah. laughs> and this is after a missing persons case was initiated. And but long story short, we've got a missing person, and Homicide Bureau has a missing persons detail within it because it's staffed by former homicide detectives, people that, you know, kind of not wanted to work the field anymore, and they work that job, but they have the knowledge and expertise and understanding of how some of these cases, you know, kind of work their way through,
yeah.
Which ones need to just be, okay, you know, this is a missing person and it's a missing person. This is a missing person that needs someone to look at it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
this one has some
there's
things about
suspicious,
it.
Suspicious. Yeah.
That require,
yeah.
You know, some investigation. So that's how we got this case. The missing persons unit gave it to us, and my lieutenant said, you know, this sounds like it's going to be a murder, Danny, and here you go.
Yeah.
So we meet the two daughters. The one daughter lives 50 miles away and was driving up there trying to find her mom, and the bad daughter lived two miles away, mm-hmm. and was like, oh, she's fine, she'll be coming back, you know, I don't know where she went. And yet, you know, all of her belongings were in the house. Her heart medication was in the house. Right. And so we look at this, at the bad daughter, and I find out very quickly that she had murdered her first husband.
Wow.
And of course, now, again, I'm not real bright, but I'm thinking, okay, there could be something here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little, yeah.
Yeah, so I...
And she was still walking around.
Oh God, you know, it was up in Northern California and they botched the case. Basically, she shoots her husband while he's sleeping, shoots him in the back of the head.
Oh my God.
And she calls it in as a suicide. And so they go in there and, you know, she's crying and, you know, just doing her bit. So they just take her word for it that it's a suicide. And then at the autopsy, you know, the medical examiner's like, hey, we got a problem over here, you know? And so by then, you know, there's no crime scene. There's, you know, everything's just, And basically, they arrest her. They end up only charging her with manslaughter because, you know, they can't really prove anything else. And she had this, you know, I was in fear of my husband type BS.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I remember briefing that case to the Bureau because we always brief our cases. And, you know, the homicide bureau, we were about 80 detectives, you know, and, I remember briefing that case. I said, can you imagine how busy we would be if men knew they could kill their wives and only have to do 3 years in prison, you know, cause that's what she did. She did 3 years. Uh-huh. And, so she's back out and, you know, she's remarried and, this dope that she marries, you know, he's not a real bright guy. And
yeah, I wouldn't say so.
And she convinces him that they need to off mom because they think mom's rich.
Yeah.
Well, also what they had done is they were in so much debt. It was just dumb. And so they were constantly borrowing money from mom. Oh, we need more money. We need more money. So they owed her a shitload of money. But what they were also doing, we figured out and proved, is they had taken all kinds of different credit out in the mom's identity.
Yeah.
So the mom confronted them and said, you know, at some point, like, okay, this money thing is, you know, it's got to stop.
Yeah, I'm a seamstress. Like, what are you doing to me?
And she lived alone, not a Lazarevich, lived alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, through our investigation, we know that the bad daughter and her dopey husband went there the last night that anyone had ever seen Nada. And ultimately it took, I mean, we were prosecuting them on what we call a no-body murder case because we hadn't found Nada.
Mm-hmm.
You know, weeks and weeks had gone by. We had teletypes going all over the state, you know, looking for this person and with information about if you come across a Jane Doe body somewhere. And it turned out that Kern County had a Jane Doe and they had, even though they'd been sent the teletype, they never matched it up.
Yeah.
And it was months later, we had already charged these guys. I think we had already made it through the preliminary hearing even. And we were going forward on a no-body murder case when Kern County, you know, during another round of teletypes, they pick it up. And they're like, wait a minute, we've got a Jane Doe here. And it turns out that when they killed her, they put her in the trunk of her own car, drove it 70 miles up into Kern County, and dumped her off the side of a desolate highway.
Jeez.
And I actually had wished they had found her because it complicated everything. There was so much damage from her out there rotting and then the animals, you know, tearing her apart and everything else.
Yeah.
That we never could actually prove definitively what the manner of death was.
Oh.
So that complicates things.
Yeah, sure.
But circumstantially, you know, we had a good case and we ended up convicting both of them. The dopey husband ended up, you know, folding like a lawn chair when we had him in the room and he gave up the whole thing. But
and the sister never suspected that her other sister had committed the murder?
Oh no, she did. She
did.
That was how we quickly got on to, in fact, she's the one that told us that, hey, you know, she killed her first husband and she's not a very good person. She's, you know, she's kind of a piece of shit. And
yeah.
I mean, it, you know, I'm no Inspector Clouseau. So, I mean, all the leads to that were, you know, pretty mm-hmm. easy to see. And the good sister was directing us, you know, with wow. good information and, wow. you know, it wasn't that tough of a case to as far as knowing who did it, it was the tough part was proving,
right.
That there was a murder, especially before we had a body,
yeah.
you know, we had to prove that she no longer existed.
Yeah.
That's part of a nobody case. You have to prove beyond any reasonable doubt that she didn't just walk off and disappear.
Right. And that's tough.
That was problem number one. Then they find the body and now we got problem number two. And that is they can't tell you how she died, you know?
Wow.
But you know, Ken, the dopey husband, ended up telling us how that all occurred. So that was a tough case. And you know, one of the interesting things about this and I know you read my book and you mentioned that you thought it was interesting is that while we're doing this investigation, 9/11 happens.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning that happened, and I'm one of those guys, I don't turn on the TV in the morning or during the day, never, ever.
Yeah.
But my wife gets a call from her girlfriend who, you know, turns the TV on the second she wakes up and she's like, oh my God, you know, look at the TV. So I was in there getting ready for our day. We had this day set up. We were going to have dopey husband Ken under surveillance all day. And we were going to serve some search warrants at his place of business and their home. And we had a pretty big day mapped out. I was getting ready for work. Mm-hmm. And my wife calls me into the living room and says, look at this, you know. And yeah, at the time, my kids were little and stuff. And, too little to even comprehend really, you know, to really understand what was going on. But they start getting up and getting ready for school. And I'm in the living room. My wife and I are both in tears sitting there going, oh, my God, you know, look at what's happened to our country.
Yeah.
And it was the strangest day ever because, you know, we went on tactical alert, you know, every law enforcement in the country did, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And nothing seemed to be happening here on the West Coast. So I called in and I'm like, okay, so are we supposed to report anywhere? And basically I was told that, no, you know, we're on tactical alert, but just do your thing because there's nothing we're going to have you do at this point, you know?
Right.
So our surveillance team that was going to follow Ken that day, they had to bail. They said, hey, we've actually been, you know, told to report to this, you know, command post. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were actually given a set of orders to do certain things. And you know, us dumb homicide cops were just, you know, to carry on and do our thing. So my partner and I, you know, again, you know, I referenced the lack of time. I mean, time is your enemy when you're a homicide cop. There's never enough minutes in the day.
Yeah.
I was like, well, you know what? You know, we might not have Ken under surveillance, but we could do A, B, C, D, and E. And you know, my partner agreed. He says, yeah, let's do it. We drive out there. This is up in the North County of Los Angeles County, up in Lancaster, Palmdale, Lancaster. And one of the things we needed to do that day was canvass the neighbor and talk to all the neighbors. And so we're going from house to house and people are inviting us into their home and talking to us about, you know, Nada and when they last saw her and everything else. But everywhere we were, you know, the TVs are on.
Yeah.
And the planes are crashing into the towers. And,
yeah, yeah.
And you're sitting there trying to focus on this job you're doing, but it seems so menial at the time.
Yeah.
And it feels disrespectful.
Yeah.
And it felt like we were intruding. Like at a moment like this, you know, why are we in these people's homes? I mean, because it wasn't that many hours before that I was on my couch in tears.
Yeah.
And now I'm in their living room, you know, asking them about their neighbor. And it was surreal.
That was a strange, strange day. In November 2012, a California state appellate court dismissed the latest appeal filed on behalf of Vanessa Walker, who was convicted along with her husband Ken Walker of murdering her 67-year-old mother, Nada Lazarevic, whose decomposing body was found by a man collecting cans off State Route 178 in Kern County about 2 weeks after she was last seen alive. The three-justice panel from California's 2nd District Court of Appeal wrote in their dismissal, and I quote, because neither defendant nor appellate counsel identified an issue warning reversal, we dismiss the appeal as abandoned. Vanessa Walker was sentenced in August 2003 to 35 years to life in state prison for her mother's slaying. Her husband, Ken Walker, was sentenced in July 2003 to 15 years to life. Could you talk about the other case, the Native American?
Yeah. So, and I'll try to make it a brief, you know, story, but I mean, it's a pretty complex deal, but William Whiteside was his name, and he was a Native American, 57 years old, I believe, 61. I forget. I think he was late 50s, early 60s. And he worked at the hospital in Lancaster in the maintenance department or housekeeping, one of the two. Uh-huh. And while he's there, he meets this gal. He had been working there for several years, and this gal gets a job there. And she's kind of a loser. She's, you know, been through several marriages. She's got two kids and neither one of them are worth a shit. She's 35, but she's, you know, really down on her luck and everything. And so she hooks up with Whiteside and, mm-hmm. and, you know, I mean, if you're 60 some years old and living alone and he wasn't divorced, but they only stayed. He had a wife, and they only stayed married so that she could have his insurance.
Okay.
But the marriage was dissolved. So
yeah,
he had been living alone for quite a while, and so he moves her in. Her name's Valerie. Mm-hmm. And he moves Valerie in with him, and shortly thereafter, one of her little shithead kids, they call Ray Ray, gets out of jail, and so now he needs to stay with them. Well, Ray Ray is a skinhead.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden, him and all of his skinhead friends are coming around the house, and pretty soon mom's back to, you know, using meth with her son and just, you know, those types of lovely things.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Whiteside gets tired of it and tells her, you got to get all these, you know, little assholes out of here. I mean, they treat him like shit. They call him the N-word because to a skinhead, anyone who's not white is the N-word. And
right.
And they call him that to his face. And you know, they're just very, very disrespectful. And of course, you know, they're stealing shit from him. And, you know, they're doing whatever they can to get more dope.
God.
And so he's had it. And he's like, you guys all have to go. And so, yeah. So mom, Valerie, mother of the year, she devises a plan that, hey, we got to get rid of him.
Wow.
And then we have this, you know, he lived in a trailer park, but it was a, you know, a nice double wide trailer in a nice, you know, little trailer park, mm-hmm. or court, whatever you want to call it. And so, I mean, his life was relatively simple till Valerie came along, you know, I mean,
yeah,
he lived a simple life. He had his job.
Yeah.
Well, he works till midnight. She calls him before he gets off work one night and says, hey, Ray Ray broke down out in the desert. Can you go pick him up? And she basically sends him out to this place that is in the remote desert. And he drives out there, and Ray Ray and two of his friends walk up and just immediately attack him through the door of his car and, you know, pull him out. And then they beat him. They beat him with their sticks and just stomp him, and they do a number on him, and they throw him in the trunk of his car, and they drive further into the desert. And at some point he's in there banging on the trunk and everything. And they pull over and open the trunk and beat him some more. And at that point, someone remembers, hey, don't forget to, you know, get his wallet. Cause, Ray, you know, Valerie has the code to his, ATM.
Yeah.
His PIN number. So they get his wallet, they beat him some more, they drive him further out, they call Valerie, and she drives out to their location with gasoline, and they burn him alive in the car.
Oh my God.
So you've got, and the way we know all the details is one of the boys, literally, he was a boy, he was 14.
Wow.
Ray Ray was 16.
Yeah.
And then there was a 27-year-old who was with them. And the 14-year-old flipped and ended up giving us, you know, every detail of the case, and also testified against the others, and he received a reduced sentence and everything. But we prosecuted, you know, the mom. She actually was given the death penalty.
Wow.
And the boys, the other two boys, were given life without the possibility of parole. But it was just, it was the most tragic case that, you know, not the most tragic case, but it was one of the most tragic cases I'd ever handled, because you had a truly innocent victim, a decent individual, you know, just a
yeah, he sounds like he was a good guy.
He was a great human being.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I mean, look at what he's doing for his wife. You know, he's stays married to her so she could have the insurance. And
yeah.
And so we end up with these four defendants and of course, most of our witnesses were also tweaker skinheads.
Yeah.
You know, people who were involved before or after the crime. This was another no body case for a while.
Yeah.
We ended up finding the body charred later. But during our investigation, you know, we've got all these people giving us information and they become witnesses. Well, they're just, you know, they're also not good people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we end up having, when we have the preliminary hearing, which lasted six freaking weeks.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was a zoo. We had to arrest and have the court hold our witnesses in custody because we kept having to go out and find them. And then we'd find them and we'd have to chase them and catch them and tackle them and bring them in.
Yeah.
They were just witnesses, but it's like, oh, cops, and they're off, you know? So And when they came to court, they told the truth. That was helpful, but
not very reliable witnesses either.
Yeah. Not real reliable. And so what happens is the judge, he assigns attorneys to all of these witnesses as well. So we got this courtroom.
Oh, wow.
Where they've got, you know, one or two attorneys for all four defendants, and then an attorney for, you know, three different witnesses.
Jeez.
You know, and the judge is a freaking attorney, you know. So, I mean, there's all these attorneys everywhere. And my partner and I, and the victim's estranged wife and her mother, were the only four people in the courtroom that actually acted like something bad had happened here.
Yeah.
I would sit there and look at these freaking skinheads, these little Nazi sons of bitches, and their attorneys, you know, are you know, whispering in their ears and joking with them and giggling.
Ugh.
And Ralph, by then in my career, I was really, really burned out.
Yeah.
And I'd been burned out for a while. My wife had been saying for a while that I was depressed and stuff. And of course I kept saying, no, I'm just tired, you know, and I'm burned out, whatever, but no, I'm not depressed.
Yeah.
It turns out that, you know, it wasn't much longer after that I found out that I had chronic PTSD and I was battling that for quite a while.
Yeah.
Still do. Chronic PTSD doesn't go away, but
right.
The point is, I was at the end of my rope and I couldn't deal with it. It was like nails on the chalkboard and I was getting pissed off and I got so pissed off that when I was on the stand and one of the attorneys questioned my integrity and pointed his finger at me and was, you know, getting in my face a little bit, I came out of my chair, out of the witness stand, right next to the judge.
Yeah.
And I leaned across and I put my finger back at him. I said, don't you ever point your finger at me.
Yeah.
And now the judge is banging his gavel on the freaking thing and telling me that,
oh, what are you doing?
Telling me I'm going to be held in contempt. And,
right, right.
And, you know, like I wrote in my book, I said, well, you know what? I was contemptuous.
Yeah.
I was fucking contemptuous at that point. I mean, I was at the point where I was going to break.
Yeah.
And truthfully, I wouldn't have been surprised if I, you know, would have done something violent to one of these. I mean, it was just, I was at that point.
You know, the way you describe it, I mean, the work just takes not only a physical toll, but a psychic toll as well.
Yeah, huge, huge.
You're dealing with the ugliest aspect of humanity on a daily basis.
Yeah, months after that preliminary hearing, and I actually ended up being retired before it went to trial. My partner did a great job of carrying that case through trial and getting those convictions. But, you know, ultimately we got through that preliminary hearing and everyone was held to answer and we were able to move forward.
Danny's experience is way too common. According to a recent article in Psychology Today, of approximately 900,000 sworn law enforcement officers in the United States, 19% of them have PTSD. Other studies suggest that approximately 34% suffer symptoms associated with PTSD, but do not meet the standards for full diagnosis. And suicide is a leading cause of death. Of the 632 law enforcement deaths across the country in 2021, almost 25% of those were self-inflicted. Law enforcement personnel are 54% more likely to die of suicide than people in other occupations.
Now I'm smiling right now, just my memories of Tommy Harris. And Tommy and I were investigating another murder with this other, you know, guy that was supposed to be a real bad dude. And we end up getting in a fight with his buddy who was a parolee at large and we didn't know it, but we went there to talk to the suspect and this other guy, we found out he was a parolee at large. The parole officer, we had him on the phone, said, bring him to jail. And this guy decided he wasn't going to jail. So we get in a fight with this guy. And, you know, again, I'm not a small guy and I'm not a pushover. Tommy is a freaking bodybuilder and a real tough guy, and he's stronger than hell. Now he used to do bodybuilding, but powerlifting especially. I mean, just a real strong guy.
Yeah.
But this guy charges through us, and we're two relatively old men at the point, and he's your typical, guy that you have to fight with, 22, 24, whatever.
Right.
And it wasn't that big of a deal. He and I went to the ground and I was above him trying to get an arm behind his back. So we handcuff him and he slips his arm and throws an elbow at my jaw. And I pull my head out of the way to avoid that. And I felt this little electric tinge in my neck.
Mm.
And then a couple of days later, I started having pain radiating down my arm. And long story short, I found out that I had ruptured a disc in my neck.
Mm.
And I ended up having a neck surgery. I returned to work probably way sooner than I should have. And what I hadn't realized was how much the stress of that job affected your physical being.
Sure.
And I would constantly deal with serious headaches. I won't call them migraines because I know people who have had migraines and I can't compare it to that, but excruciating headaches. And also my neck and my back would lock up on me,
Wow.
And just feel like they all froze and it was the tension.
Yeah.
And usually that happened in the office or whatever, but as you mentioned, I get to work one day and it's just, typical way to start your day at homicide. You got freaking a new stack of subpoenas on your desk. You got six different prosecutors calling saying they need everything yesterday and four defense attorneys saying they need to go through all their discovery and new on call sheets showing that we're first up again for murderers. And you're always buried.
Yeah.
And they give us this case of a human head hanging in a tree. And that's how my book starts. In fact, I'll say this, you can go on Amazon and look at my book and just read the first chapter or two, cause it's in there. And that's how the book starts. I start with that day, that the last day of
it's a memorable day too.
Very memorable. And that's how I start.
Great opening of a book.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So I get this and it's like, of course I'd been around, hundreds, probably thousands of dead people by then. And in all sorts of configurations and disfigurements and a human head hanging a tree, to the average guy, it's a really, really creepy thing. And normally I think it probably wouldn't have been that big of a deal, but just kind of like the needle, or the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
I'm like driving down the road going, are you fucking kidding me? And I'm on the phone with my partner because we're going to the scene from two different places. Mm-hmm. And I'm dealing with freaking traffic on the Long Beach freeway. And I'm in a Crown Vic, and I got my excuse me lights on, in other words, get the F out of the way because
right.
I'm a cop and I need to hurry.
Right.
Although I'm pretty sure that head was going to be there no matter when I arrive. but that's, it's just part of being a cop. It's like, hey, get out of my way. I'm coming down the fast lane. Move over.
Right.
And I got some dipshit in front of me that's not moving over. And I'm getting pissed. I'm like, okay, I got to go around him. So I go to swerve. But before I do, I look over my shoulder to make sure I'm clear.
Yeah.
And when I did, my neck locked up. And I couldn't turn my head.
Yeah.
And I was still on the phone with my partner. I'm talking to him while all this is going on. And all of a sudden, I go radio silence, and pretty soon he's like, hey, are you there? Are you there? Well, what had happened was I go into this, basically I'm suddenly tunnel vision because like being in a shooting or something, you're not even aware of everything else going around you. You've got this, deadly encounter that you're trying to deal with.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was going 75 miles an hour one direction, but being stuck looking the other.
Yeah, that's rough.
Not a good scenario, And I turn my whole body.
Yeah.
Because my neck is literally froze. I have to turn my whole body so that I can see ahead of me. And finally, I start to come out of that heightened sense of whatever it is that causes tunnel vision. And I realize my partner's going, dude, what is going on with you? What is going on?
Yeah.
I let out this big breath. I'm like, oh man, I go, I just had my neck lock up again.
Mm.
And he had kind of been a little bit of an advocate for me to take better care of myself for a while. He knew that I was having to use pain medication to get through the day.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally said, he goes, dude, he goes, you gotta get that neck fixed, Bubba. That was his quote. And, And I actually, I just drove home that day. I left the, the office that day, didn't bother checking in or telling anyone or anything. I called the doctor. They had been treating me, and I said, I need to see the doctor. And they tried to set an appointment. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm coming there now.
Yeah.
I need to see the doctor.
Yeah.
Because I knew I was done, Ralph, at that point.
Yeah.
There was no doubt in my mind.
I
had a little come to Jesus with myself and anyway, and the doctor, when he heard the story, that was his words were, you're finished.
Yeah.
And of course, when he said that, I mean, I broke down. It was like, even though I knew that it was the truth and I knew it was coming and I knew he would be saying it.
Yeah.
It just was the most lonely feeling on earth, because, when you're a cop, it's not a job, man. It's an identity. It's a identity, a family, a loved,
Yeah.
So it all came crashing down on me. And that was my last day as a cop. I was done.
Wow. Wow.
I was absolutely done. And I've been through a lot.
Yeah.
In the healing process. And I try to talk to people about PTSD and depression stuff. I've had a hell of a lot of friends commit suicide.
Jeez.
Friends or colleagues, I should say. And
wow.
Some overtly, and others who just, drank themselves to death or something. And
right.
And
right.
I consider myself fortunate that I've been able to battle through it, and I've got a good support system, and I've done okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a little bit, not normal,
Who is normal? Yeah.
But I'm doing okay, Ralph.
Yeah. And that same day, you sort of found your second profession.
Well, it was later. It was a little bit later.
A couple days later. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the agreements, because my doctor wanted to put me on these meds for the depression and everything. And I tried it and I hated it. I think I took it for 2 or 3 days and I went back to him. I said, I can't do this. I say in my book, I felt like this is what tweakers must feel like.
Yeah.
Because everything was amplified and brilliant and bright and noisy. And to me, it had an adverse effect on me. And I said, I can't do this. And he said, we can try a different one. I said, no, I don't want to do drugs. I said, I'll take the fight head on, man.
Right.
And he agreed. He said, okay, but I want you to go see a counselor. And he sent me to this counselor, who was a shrink, and big leather sofas and all that good stuff. and before my first appointment with him, they had sent me this questionnaire that I found absurd. It had like a question like, do you believe your job causes you stress? And maybe half a paragraph's worth of blank lines that I was supposed to answer that question. Next question, what about your job causes stress? So I just wrote across the thing.
Heads hanging in trees. Yeah. Guys coming at you with bricks. Yeah.
Yeah. I put a diagonal line across it and wrote see attached. And I just started typing my story, and I always was, I always was known to be a good report writer. And, mm-hmm. And I always enjoyed writing, never considered myself a writer, but I type up this thing. And I mean, I was brutally honest about every freaking aspect of it. And when this shrink, this guy's got, all kinds of initials before and after his name and everything, and this big imposing desk, that he's sitting behind, and he keeps looking at me, he's holding this up. He goes, Danny, he goes, you got to write for a living.
Yeah.
And of course, I was in one ear and out the other. I'm like, hey doc, what's up with being on the rubber gun squad? that's where I'm at now. Right. Let's address that. Forget the writing part.
Right.
But years later, and he kept reiterating, he said, writing is very therapeutic. You might find it's very helpful. And that's why I'm a writer.
Yeah.
He was absolutely correct.
Yeah.
His mother should be proud for the money they spent to send him to school. He knew what he was talking about. I found it extremely therapeutic to write. Mm-hmm. And that's how I started writing. And I wrote novels. Mm-hmm. I've got eight published novels, but
wow.
It took me, well, I think it's been 3 years now that I published my memoir, The Nothing Left to Prove.
Yeah.
And so I've been retired for, I think, 21 years.
Mm-hmm.
No, not quite. 2004 is when I retired. Mm-hmm. But it took me probably at least 15 years before I was able to do that. And I had thought about it previously, and I, had considered it a time or two, but it was something I didn't want to do because it's one thing to write novels. It's another thing to dig into the truth.
Yeah.
And when I wrote it, I had a lot of trouble. The nightmares came back. The depression came back.
Yeah.
I battled writing that book. My wife would attest to that. So it was tough, but I think it was therapeutic for me to get through it, to finish it, to publish it. And then to see all the response that I get from it, from cops all over the world.
Yeah.
Who read it. They say, God, every cop should read this book.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that was probably the most healing part of the process, truthfully, is that I feel like that book has something for everyone. I mean, it's every cop story. I tell mm-hmm. people that it's every cop story. It's just mine's different than yours, but
right.
Every cop will relate to parts of that story. And if it helps anyone, you know, then God bless them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're very well versed now in PTSD for people in combat. But you don't realize it, the toll that being a policeman has on people. You know, when you think about it, it makes more sense because it's like, you know, it's in your own neighborhood. It's your neighbors. It's a familiar area. But you're seeing a side of it that most of us don't see. You're dealing with sort of an ugliness that, you know, runs beneath our society that doesn't go away. It's there constantly and you're battling it. And meanwhile, the people around you are completely unaware of it. Like they might catch a glimpse of it on an evening news broadcast or something like that, or a police show. But, you know, you're dealing with the human toll of it. And that's got to be psychically very, very difficult.
Yeah. And interestingly, you mentioned the combat veteran. My shrink said that's how he explained the difference between acute and chronic PTSD. He said that, you know, acute PTSD is found in people that you know, suffer one traumatic experience.
Yeah.
And chronic PTSD is what they most commonly find in combat veterans. And he said that what they have been figuring out over the, you know, last couple of decades is that the PTSD that they're finding in cops is very, very much akin to what they're seeing in combat veterans.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a kind of an interesting thing, but, you know, the main thing is that truthfully, I mean, we need to talk about it more.
Yeah, absolutely.
My department had a shocking thing happen 2 weeks ago. Actually, it wasn't even 2 weeks ago. I think it was last week. We had four different suicides in a 48-hour period. And
wow.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know what, you know, the news is that, you know, they're unrelated.
Yeah.
You know, there's speculation of other things, but regardless, I mean, talk about, you know, just a devastating thing for an agency to go through.
No, that's awful. That's just horrific.
Yeah.
And you keep reading statistics that, you know, the suicide rate among police is higher than ever.
And we have more suicides than line of duty deaths every year.
Yeah.
That's my understanding anyways, we meaning law enforcement. And I can tell you that a lot of suicides are never even called suicides. Like I said, I've got a couple of friends who literally drink themselves to death.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't call that a suicide, but
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
a lot of cops, overindulge and,
yeah,
you know, and that's it.
Well, Danny, thank you so much. This has been, really excellent. God bless you, man. Thanks for your service and thanks for speaking out and writing about PTSD that policemen and law enforcement officers have to deal with. I think probably, especially now, more than ever.
Thank you, Ralph, for those very kind words. I appreciate it.
During his 21-year career in law enforcement, Danny R. Smith stared death in the face on a nightly basis. He witnessed shootings, children killed or shot, injuries and deaths to his fellow officers, unsolved murders, and a whole lineup of other traumatic events, including being brutally beaten to within an inch of his life. These events took a cumulative psychological toll that snuck up on him and ended his career. Fortunately, Danny found another highly productive pursuit after he retired from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and moved his family to Idaho, that of a writer who has so far produced 8 gritty police detective novels and an excellent and very honest law enforcement memoir, Nothing Left to Prove. You can find them at Amazon and on his website, DickieFloydNovels.com. We thank him for his service and for his honest portrayal of the challenges of being a beat cop and detective in the county of Los Angeles. It's my great honor to name Danny R. Smith as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Fazzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.